From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Guess who's here again with me today, gardeners? Ken?
Yes. I was guessing.
Are you here, Ken?
I'm guessing I'm here.
That voice is longtime garden writer, author, and photographer, and all-around great gardener, Ken Drews, and friend, by the way, great friend, of kendrews.com. And hearing his voice is a tip-off that it's once again time to answer your urgent garden questions. But first, Ken, I have one for you. Mm-hmm. And it's really urgent.
No.
Okay, this is like, it's not only urgent, it's like sort of, you know, philosophical and existential. Do you ever get to the end of your to-do list?
No, because there's always something being added.
It's the damnedest thing working with a medium that grows when you turn your back on it, right? It like regrows.
You know, so many people say, I can't wait to get the garden done. And I think, what are you talking about? It's never done. And we don't want it to be done.
No, it's something
you can do for a lifetime, crawling around the garden as I'm doing this week because I've got my back issue. So, but I'm crawling around.
Oh, that's interesting. So you're crawling because your back is bothering you, and I'm crawling because I'm on a bittersweet hunt, which is, you know, I have all these big, giant shrubberies, these mature, you know, like 20 shrubs in one giant border kind of islands. And, you know, the birds then find the oriental bittersweet somewhere growing. They gobble up some fruit. They come, they sit in one of my shrubs in the middle of a bed, and then they poop. And then I get hundreds of bittersweet seedlings, and that's what I'm doing. I'm exhuming, excavating, excommunicating bittersweet. What are you doing?
I'm pulling some of them too, and they have yellow roots, as you may or may not know.
Yeah, like orange yellow, very characteristic. Yeah,
so that's good because when I pull it and I think, uh-oh, what did I pull out? If I see I think they're yellow. I pull out the yellow and I see the yellow roots. I think, oh, yes, I pulled the right thing as opposed to that million-dollar vine I just planted.
Right. What else are you up to? On the to-do list.
On the to-do? Oh, my gosh, it's so big. Well, I had to make a list of the small trees that I have. Mm-hmm. And I tried not to make a list of small trees that I want.
Mm-hmm. But we'll talk that later, I know.
Yeah, that's exciting because, as you probably know, I'm into the woodies more and more these days. Because, well, they say that those herbaceous things are perennial, but I find a lot of them don't come back. So I'm not sure they're annuals or perennials. But the woody plants, they do it for me, and they don't need a whole lot of care. And when I prune them, if I have to prune them, I kind of like it.
Yeah. So, you know, our mutual friend who was the founding gardener, horticultural director at Wave Hill, Marco Stufano, Wave Hill, the garden, the public garden in New York City in Riverdale in the Bronx, he says that we're in the shrub season of our lives as we become older gardeners. He says that's the shrub season. It's like you don't want to mess around with a bunch of fussy perennials, but the shrubs really are satisfying. And like you said, you know, they give you a lot. They don't really demand that much, but you can do some tinkering. You know,
well, and you can also shrink your garden. You know, some people think their gardens are too large and they want to move to an adult community or something. And I just say shrink it. Put some more deciduous shrubs along the outside of the garden.
I've got a
Colquitsia here that's probably 20 years old. It doesn't bloom for very long, unfortunately, but I have never touched that plant. I've never watered it. I've never pruned it. It probably needs a pruning. It's bigger than a Volkswagen Beetle, but
it's beauty bushes, I think they call it. Sort of an old-fashioned favorite, right?
Right. You know, you're saying these things, and I'm thinking of what's kind of on my mind. And something that's on my mind is killing plants. You mentioned Marco, and one thing about Marco, I mean, he's a real gardener. He is a real professional gardener. And if he's tired of something, he'll just get rid of it. And he'll give it to someone, or he'll put it on the compost pile.
Yeah.
And I'll have this half of a basil with two brown leaves and one little green hope at the top. And I'll coddle it and coddle it. And then after 6 months, it finally croaks. but I can't seem to toss it. That was just an example, not necessarily true.
Well, one of his other quotable quotes to that, subject is, he says, bury your dead and fast. In other words, when they're limping, don't even let them croak completely. Oh, you put them in the compost heap.
Good idea.
Bury your dead and fast. We can get back to some of our complaining, moaning, and laughing, but enough of our saga of chores unfinished for the moment. I believe we have a caller on the line named Robert, if I'm not mistaken. You know I get mistaken sometimes. Robert, are you there?
That's me, and that's correct.
Oh, good. See, I got it right. First time lucky. Where do you garden, Robert?
I have a garden floor apartment in a brownstone in Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn.
Oh, and what question brings you to us today?
I have these stewardia trees, a pair of stewardia trees that I planted maybe 8 or 9 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And they've taken off and they're really healthy. And the question was really about how the... I've had many seasons with them, but this year, for some reason, there's a profusion of blossoms like I've never seen before.
Oh.
On both of these trees. I mean, it's all happy news, but I was puzzled as to why, because I didn't do anything to deserve this. So I didn't fertilize, and I also am not a big waterer. I've been listening in, and this is the third incarnation of this garden, and for me, this is like the low, no-maintenance garden.
Yes.
Where I used to be spending hundreds of dollars a year in perennials.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's all, ferns and astilbes and hydrangeas that come back. And these two stewardias in the center, kind of making a vertical screen so that the place feels deeper or more mysterious than it actually is.
Nice, but
a foil. Yeah, so the blossoming is the question I had, because I just don't know what made for it, because there was no kind of change back here,
right.
Really.
So you didn't do anything. These are stewardia pseudo-camellia, I assume, since you're in Brooklyn.
Yes,
okay, so
right.
Ken, have you grown them? Do you have any insights here for Rob?
I actually have. I never got one, because I thought it takes too long. Because it takes a long time for them to bloom, and then another 20 years, and you see the beautiful, patchy, camouflage bark. So I always thought, I'm not going to live long enough. And that's crazy. So about 2 years ago, I planted one, and it's only about 4 feet tall, and it's got buds all over it. And I think there's a lot of reasons why your stewardias are blooming. The main one is that they're older, because they do take a long time to bloom generally. And I also wanted to mention that pseudocamellia, the specific epithet, is false camellia, because it has big white flowers that kind of resemble single camellias. So one thing is that time, they're older plants.
Yeah.
Another, I don't know if a tree in the neighbor's yard was taken down, or somehow they got a little more light. Another thing is that we've had a wonderful spring in the Northeast with about almost an inch of rain every week, just perfect. So a lot of things are doing really well. I guess a couple of other things. Yeah, were you going to say something, Robert?
No, I just was going to add that I've heard that all over. I was in Sag Harbor for the weekend, and my friend's garden, we had a cocktail party, and everyone admitted that the garden looked better than ever. And she's also a lazy gardener that hires other people to do.
Well,
to the best of us, we all need to turn to some help every now and again.
Oh my God, I feel like I like that option more and more.
Oh no, you wouldn't. Come on. Then you wouldn't, you couldn't complain as much. But I did want to mention one more thing, that one more reason why it could be blooming, which is not a wonderful reason. We had two dry, hot summers in a row, and with drought, really. And last summer was very hot, very dry, and I lost a lot of plants this year that just didn't leaf out. But sometimes flowering trees will put on a big show because they're trying to guarantee the future of the species by making fruit. So some plants that are stressed will go into a big, mature, blooming phase in order to guarantee the future. And that's another okay. reason why it could have happened. But I think this all sounds like good news. And you must be a gardener because you're apologizing and you're kvetching about something wonderful. And that makes you a gardener, I'd say. Don't you think, Margaret?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
so,
wow.
So Ken, yeah,
yeah.
Totally. So, Ken, you're saying, so age, of course. And I had read, I don't know, somewhere, and I hope I'm not confusing it with another species of tree, but or genus of tree, but I had read something like that they don't even bloom, like you said, but till like age 11 or 12 or, you know, something not like early, like opposite
really?
Of sort of magnolias, which
right.
are what's called precocious,
right.
as they
right.
bloom from a very, you know, can have this magnolia with this one giant flower on it that's this tiny little
yeah.
twig practically.
Mm-hmm.
These are kind mm-hmm. of the opposite. And then you also said, Ken, sometimes light conditions can change because something in the environment beyond your yard even has changed, and then more moisture, I think. And I'm so I'm in a different place. I'm upstate a couple few hours from you, Robert, and mine is blooming pretty heavily. I've probably had it for 20 something years, my Stewardia.
Oh, wow.
And
how tall is yours?
20 something feet.
Oh,
yeah.
Thick.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so, you know, but I would say that generally speaking, that the more moisture, the dry years are the worst on this tree. And it kind of makes sense when I look at those buds, which look like white marbles. Mm. They're kind of big.
Yeah,
they're not teeny.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I mean,
no,
you'd have to get a lot of moisture to sort of hydrate that and unfurl that thing, right?
I suppose, yeah.
Yeah, and plus, those flowers, like a lot of the things in that camellia tea, that tea family, that camellias and stuff are in, the flowers, don't they like open for a day and then like fall off and then you get
yeah,
another?
See, I thought there was something wrong with the tree,
no.
but then as I read more about them, that's sort of its habit. But I'm sort of like charmed by the way they don't fall off by the petals. It's like this little ballerina dress that just
yeah.
sort of drops off the ground.
but yeah, seriously, the tea family, isn't that right, Ken? Am I making this up, or is it in the tea family? Camellias and stewardias are all related. And don't they, like if you're in a camellia greenhouse, you know, a botanical
yeah.
garden, there's like all these flowers on the floor, but there's still many flowers on the tree because it blooms sequentially, like daylilies. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean.
So you have to get a bowl of water for the center of the table and have a party and float some blossoms in the water for that evening.
And I want to, you know, I get a lot of, and I want to ask you, Robert, your experience with this, with your two 8 or 9 year old stewardias, because I get this.
It must be older, because I'm looking at it, and I think it's 16 feet.
Well, it probably had 5 or 8 years on it when you got it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
So, because we have to remember that they've been in a nursery somewhere for a number of years.
Sure.
Yeah, which is why plants are expensive, and rightly so in many cases.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, a lot of questions because of Google searches that I get about Stewardia, because I have a few articles about Stewardia on the website. People come to me and ask about pruning them. And I had one
just did that.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. So have you ever pruned yours? Because I had one from a woman called Nabat. She used as her login name.
Hmm.
She'd moved to a new place. Stewardia is looking very healthy, plenty of buds, looking forward to the flowers. But she wants to know how to prune it and when because, you know, it's grown very wide. Hers is in a restricted space. You've pruned yours?
Well, look, I don't want to admit that I know what I'm doing.
No, I was just curious, what was the reason that prompted you?
The reason it prompted is because they're getting big. The reason I bought them is because I think they can have a sort of vertical habit.
Right.
And almost like birches. And because the branches were heavily laden with blossoms, I wanted to wait till that was completed, which is almost complete. And so I pruned up to expose some more of the trunk and bark in this Brooklyn garden so that the whole place wasn't just consumed by these trees.
Okay.
And so, you know, like I said, I'm not sure. I know a little about pruning, but I'm no expert.
Right.
So I just looked at it in terms of trying to diminish its, shiness.
Yeah. So Ken, how would you, and this is a tree that has a very distinctive shape and people frequently like it for its natural shape. You don't want to hack back the ends of all the branches of this tree, right, Ken?
Absolutely not. Right.
How would you approach it if you had to, Ken?
Well, I would prune it after blooms, just as Robert is doing or has
okay.
done. And if you need the head space, then to limit up a little bit and
expose the trunk, you mean?
Yes. And because maybe you want to walk there or something if the limit. It's a small garden, so I don't think he had a whole lot of choice. And in this case, he's going to see more of that beautiful bark.
Yeah. So this is, but this is not a tree to shear, and that's the important thing with something that has a distinctive shape is that, you know.
I totally agree. And what I did was I look at this, the proportion of the stem, and then select the branch I think needs to have something happen to it, and then I take it back to the trunk,
right?
And where it's coming from, and I put it from there so that natural habit is hurt.
Well, I'm so glad you called us with your urgent stewardia question, Robert, because it brings up a good topic about a favorite tree of both of ours, and it's great to talk to you. Thanks. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much. I'm sure I have many other urgent questions for another time.
I'll get on the list.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Yeah, Ken, you know, it's interesting. I didn't know that you didn't have one in your old garden or your current garden until recently, but you do, as you were saying earlier, have a lot of, you're more of a woody plant person, especially now, and you were just making a list of like favorite small trees. A lot of times they talk about this stewardia as like a small, a choice small tree for the garden, meaning like it doesn't get to 60 feet or 100 feet.
35 feet.
Yeah. Yeah. So are there others that you treasure like this? And also, I guess we should have said, and you sort of implied it with your description, it's kind of a multi-season tree, right? Which is what makes the choice.
It's great. Because you get fall color too, don't you?
Absolutely,
so
yeah.
It's purpley, flowers, fall orange. Color, beautiful exfoliating bark. I'd call that four seasons, you bet.
Yeah. Yeah, and plus the fact that it's, again, not like a 60 or 80 foot tree makes it a choice kind of garden tree for all seasons, et cetera. So what are some of the others that, if Robert had more room, we could convince him to?
Well, sometimes you just can't be stopped, but it sounds like he can be.
Yeah, he did very
all the dogwoods. That's the first thing that comes to mind are the dogwood trees.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we've talked about Corniscusa wolfeyes, which I adore and has done so wonderfully for me. I got my first one at Trade Secrets near you.
And like it was that. About, yeah, tell people that's like a garden trade fair sort of spring festival.
And it's a fundraiser. It's for charity.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think it was about 3.5 feet tall, and now it's 12 feet tall and 10 feet wide, and it's one of the most beautiful things in the garden. And
describe it.
Last year it was covered with flowers for the first time after a bad summer. And this year it has quite a few flowers, but it's gray-green with a creamy white edge on all the leaves. Mm-hmm. And it's very dense. And I've got it in like half-day sun, which is another thing about that stewardia. That's a tree for when you don't have a lot of sun because it doesn't like a lot of sun, which is a great thing to have for...
Do in a non-baking situation,
right.
Yeah.
So I've got that Corniscusa. I've got several Cornus floridus, which are the eastern dogwood, although one of mine comes from the mountains of Mexico. There's the Rutgers hybrids. You know about those, Margaret?
Mm-hmm. So now those are hybrids between, these are dogwoods again, hybrids between.
Well, sometimes it's a hybrid between Corniscusa and Cornus florida, but there are some that are hybrids between Cornus florida and Cornus natali, the western dogwood. And they're a little bit bigger, but they're disease resistant, which is how it sort of started. Because the Cornus florida, if you have it in a place with not such great air circulation or a lot of trees around it, they can get anthracnose, which disfigures the leaves and could ultimately kill the trees. But a lot of people grow dogwoods in the middle of the lawn, and they love that, which actually a stewardia would not like that. Too much nitrogen.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you said about the variegated Corniscusa, the wolfeyes, wolfeye, whatever it's called. I always get it wrong. I killed that tree, and it was anthracnose. I guess it wasn't me. It was anthracnose in a wet, tricky year when the native dogwoods around me had it. It's one of the kusas that's more susceptible to anthracnose, it turns out. I learned posthumously. You know what I mean? When I did some research about, like, why did this happen to my tree? Because I thought kusas, as well as the hybrid, you said, are a little less resistant than our native species. So just a PS. Anyway, sorry, I interrupted.
More resistant.
Yeah.
Well, I'm making believe that's not the case. I'm just going to ignore that horrible thought about this tree, which is, you know, really just a focal point of the garden. I have a lot of cirsus red buds, and I have a couple of white red buds, which I always think is kind of funny to say. I have a white red bud. But I do have white red bud, and I have a couple of forest pansies. Do you know forest pansy? Margaret?
I do know forest pansy. I have not grown it successfully, but I do know it. So
you have not grown it successfully?
No.
Because it croaked?
Yes, I've killed a lot of things, Ken, in my time.
No, this is good. It's good to talk about because forest pansies tend to croak. And I just wanted to mention that because a lot of people are beating themselves up because they don't know why their forest pansies have croaked. And I had one that I planted here, and it became the largest forest pansy I'd ever seen, and it croaked. And the best ones I've seen, actually, you know, you kind of have to think, where did this tree come from? Because even though Cirsus canadensis, it grows from way down south to way up north into Canada, that doesn't mean they're all the same. And I think forest pansy might come from a specific, the original one that wasn't purple.
Right.
Have come from a part of the country that's kind of specific, or maybe growing on rock, because I've noticed that a lot of Cirsus like to grow on in shallow soil on rock. So if you plant it too deep or if you plant it in a wet spot, that might contribute to its demise. In my case, I think perhaps being underwater might have contributed to its demise.
Right.
Because it was after the big flood. You know, we could talk about Japanese maples, but we can't because this show is not 6 days long.
True.
But I had to pick one Japanese maple. I would say Acer japonicum actinidifolium. And it's called actinidifolium because the leaves are feathery and deeply cut like the leaves of aconitum, which doesn't help people, monkshood.
Yeah.
But it has just about the best fall color of any tree, I think. The leaves are green and beautiful, and it's so easy to grow. And the color sort of starts as if the color almost bleeds through the leaves over a period of about 2 weeks. And it's really, it's orange and yellow and rich green and blood red and kind of a maroony purple all at the same time. And it's so easy to grow and dependable. And that when I say small, because you can get a Japanese maple that stops at 2 feet, this one grows to probably about 25, 30 feet. And they are beautiful, beautiful bark, everything. Can't say enough of them. And have you noticed that, am I talking too much? Have you noticed that?
Quiet. Would you just please be quiet? No.
You know how everybody used to plant those awful Bradford pears everywhere?
Oh, yeah, the calorie pears.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That split in the snow and the ice. Well, I've noticed that cities, towns, are planting the summer blooming lilac, the tree lilacs.
That's a good small tree. I used to have one of those. Syringa reticulata, is that what it is?
Well, that's one of them, because there's also a subspecies, Pekinensis, which has, it looks like, the bark looks like cherry, only it exfoliates.
It's almost a little metallic, like coppery bronzy, the bark. Yeah, nice. It's a nice,
And it has smelly flowers, big plumes, right, exactly.
Yeah,
They don't smell like regular lilacs, spring lilacs. They smell more like privet, but still.
I lost mine of that too, not having anything to do with that I killed it, but that there was work, underground power, you know, lines or something like had to be dug out by, you know, trenched out for a repair in the house at one point, and it destroyed that, the root system of that plant had to be moved. But I'm thinking of getting another one. I miss that tree.
Yeah, it's such an easy tree to grow, and it makes a nice shape all by itself.
Yeah.
So it's kind of plant it and forget it, and it blooms later than a lot of the flowering trees. So I think that's a winner, especially for something to plant and not even think about, and then you think about it when it's got these giant creamy white plumes. There's even one that has yellow flowers.
So now we've talked about trees, small trees, great trees, sturdy trees. Oh, my goodness. And now we're going to have to take a break. Now, we are going to do overtime, right? We're going to do some overtime. So people who are smart enough to subscribe to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or iTunes, which is free, 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 can listen to more and more and more. Those listening live on radio won't hear the overtime, but we are going to take a break. And I hope you all will do so. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe free to the podcast version. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com. You can find Ken at kendrews.com. Or you can find me and ask some questions at facebook.com/awaytogarden. See you in a minute.
Away to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.
Are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay, still thinking about trees?
I am. Can I talk more about them?
Only if you behave for 2 seconds, but then I have to ask you all the other questions because we've just got.
I just will end something.
Okay. You want to tell me one more thing?
Oh, yeah. Are we sort of on?
Yeah, we're on.
We're talking to the people who are smart enough to subscribe.
Exactly.
Smart enough. I have pictures of small trees dancing in my head. Stop it. I love those small trees. Okay, right. I'm with you again. I'm calming down.
Okay, calm down. Take your meds, honey. I have a question I suspect others are having at this moment from Zoe via email, via the contact form on my website, which is an email. She says, help, several of my peonies have powdery mildew. She says, from what I've read, it's best to prevent early on, but now that the blooms have passed, what, if any, action should I take to clean/remove the mildew? Did you know that there's like 11,000 species of powdery mildew organisms?
I don't doubt it for one millionth of a second. There's like 12 growing on the sponge in the kitchen right now.
So the basic thing is, you know, when you get warm days, cool nights, you know, it can be good conditions for it. And if the spores exist, obviously, that's what's happened to Zoe. I mean, my point of view is, once it happens, you don't get rid of it this season, right?
Right. And, you know, it doesn't seem to really ever be almost.
It's not a kill.
It doesn't kill it. Yeah, it's not terminal. It's just unsightly. It's very unsightly. And the lilacs always get it at the end of summer. But it doesn't seem to really kill them.
No. And really, it's fungal. So the first thing, and when she said peonies, you know, I was like, okay, wait a minute. You know, I always like to check.
Botrytis, right.
You like to check with peonies because they'd get other fungal diseases that look slightly different. And so you always want to look. And so it's great to go to, you know, whether it's Missouri Botanical Gardens website or somewhere like that, Cornell, you know, or if you live in a different region, pick a different region, you know, to a botanical garden website and look at some pictures, you know, look at some pictures of the different fungal diseases of the plant, I think, because then you can be more sure. I think she's sure. I think she knows what it is.
Right.
Yeah, but so really with these fungal things, prevention is the thing. But the thing is, the fungicides that were used for prevention, I don't want to be spraying that stuff. I don't want to be using that stuff, right?
I want to go back in time. I'd like to be 26, but that's another story.
Okay.
I think you said prevention, and I would say for peonies, especially if you see any kind of disease on them in the fall, when things are quieting down and everything's turning brown and stuff, that's one plant that I would cut the foliage off and discard and not put on the compost.
I put it in the garbage. Correct. I agree with you. Anything with a mildew situation or let alone a
botrytis.
Yeah. The fungal diseases. I agree with you. You know, a really, really, really good cleanup, including raking up under the plants and so forth, like really cleaning up the area late summer and fall. If it's really disfigured, discolored, you know, besmirched, you can even cut off some of the worst affected stuff so that you're limiting the number of spores that are like flying around. But you don't want to defoliate the plant entirely early in the season. So, you know, that's a judgment call, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, like rosarians and so forth, people have looked for what's a natural, safe, you know, antifungal kind of preventive thing instead of fungicides. And isn't there like a baking soda recipe?
I used to use that. It was like something like a tablespoon of baking soda to a gallon of water. And then you need something for a spreader stick or a surfactant, like dish soap, or better would be some kind of sun oil, some kind of natural oil spray, just to keep it so it spreads over the leaves. But a lot of people, especially rose people, really had, you know, not as much success as napalm, but a lot of success with baking soda. And of course, that's perfectly safe.
Right. So what they did at, I looked it up in Cornell's website, because I remembered that, like, it was like, oh gosh, it was a number of years ago, like the late 80s or 90s or something, they had done a bunch of testing, and it was what you said. They used a little extra baking soda, like 4 teaspoons instead of just a tablespoon, and a gallon of water.
Well, four teaspoons is just a little more than a tablespoon, right?
Right, that's what I'm saying, just a teeny bit more, and 33% more specifically. And they put a couple tablespoons of like sun spray or one of the ultra-fine sort of year-round horticultural oils, again, not toxic, and they put that in a no-clog kind of hose end sprayer. And then they did, but they sprayed them, and again, prophylactically, so not once there was an outbreak. This wasn't as preventive. They sprayed them every 3 to 4 days, and they really had tremendous improvement, you know, prevention. So anyway, so that's, I just wanted to get that question out there for Zoe. And I think we have a caller on the line, actually, Linda. Is Linda there?
I am.
And
where are you? Nice to talk to you.
Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Lilburn, Georgia, which is just outside Atlanta, northeast of Atlanta, and it's kind of hot and steamy here as opposed to what you guys have.
Right. We actually are having a break from the humidity, which we were very thankful for, but I guess you're not, huh?
No. We full tilt. We were in Maine and Canada recently and enjoyed it and came back and walked into a wall of humidity, and it hasn't left since I got home.
So. Oh, my goodness.
Just kind of here.
So what's your question that brings you to us?
Well, part of it, I guess, is because of all the rain that we've had, but I seem to be overrun with the little pill bugs, sow bugs, both kinds. I do kind of know what they are. And they're everywhere. They're in my planters. They're under my planters.
Oof.
They're, you know, I picked up a stick out of the garden, and it was, you know, rotting stick, and that's what they eat. I know that. And it was covered, literally, from one end to the other. We've gotten maybe 2 strawberries this summer because they crawl up onto the, it's not really off the ground, but any little ding in the strawberry, and they're on it, and there'll be 2 or 3 on it just chomping away. And I know they're detritus eaters, but it feels like they're actually eating the stems of some of the plants that are in my planters.
Right.
Where it stays moist and, you know, and I know that's what they like. And
okay.
What can I do?
Yeah. Ken, do you get them a lot or not?
Yes, but I've never heard of that. I mean, I'll lift a pot and they'll be under the pot. And they're, as you said, Linda, they eat usually decayed stuff and fallen leaf or something. I've never had them attack nice live growth.
Right. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, that was my understanding too. But the fact that they're so thick in my planters and on the strawberry plants, and they're out in the sun, which surprises me because I know they don't like that.
Right.
But they just seem to be everywhere, and it's just kind of overwhelming and kind of gross.
Right. So, I mean, so there are 2 kinds of these creatures that are sort of related. And one thing that's super interesting about them, since we have to put a positive spin, you probably all already know this, is that they're more closely related to crustaceans than they are to insects. They have 7 pairs of legs. And, you know, so there's, I guess they call them sow bugs, and then there's pill bugs. And the pill bugs are the roly-polies. And the sow bugs have those two little appendages at the rear end, you know, that you can see coming out back. So there's these 2 things, and you're right, they're detritivores. They eat debris and recycle stuff, and they normally feed at night or in the evening and at night. And the tricky part is that apparently, you know, I've read a little bit about them in the past, and apparently when there's a big population of them, and they'll also eat soft, you know, tender, like seedlings. They will eat seedlings. They will eat, like you say, like fruit, you know, tender bits of things. So they will do that because it's kind of soft the way that decaying debris is soft. So unfortunately.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I'm not completely crazy on that.
No. And so that's the thing is that normally what the experts say is, oh, no, that's not who's eating the stuff. You probably have slugs as well, and you're just not seeing the slugs, you're seeing the roly-polies, right? But sometimes they can, in fact, eat tender shoots, and they are known to do that. So the thing to do, the only thing to do really is that, and it's not easy, it's like, you know, how do you limit moist, dark hiding spaces? And I find that I mean, like flower pots can't be on the ground. They have to be raised. Do you know what I mean? When you have a profusion of them,
right.
You know, anything that's on in contact with the ground, creating that moist, dark place mm-hmm. is tricky. You know, water early in the day, not at later in the day, so that they're not, it's not moist when they're active. You know, this is the, and even... some people I've read have told about said that they like elevate like with strawberry plants and stuff, like they put them up on, you know, like almost like screens, you know, like frames and screens, like mm-hmm. elevating stuff yeah. off the ground. But I mean, it gets to be kind of crazy, right?
It does, and I have, I mean, most of my pots are on feet.
Right.
You know, they're not in
That's
direct
good.
Contact with
That's
the ground,
good.
But that I was out digging around in the two planters by the front porch yesterday, and they're just crawling with them,
right?
And just everywhere.
So
and,
one, yeah. So you could try to trap uh-huh. or attract them in least toxic ways, and one would be to roll up, you know, newspaper tubes on the soil surface, you know, and let them hopefully crawl into there, you know, sort of attracting them. Some people have
okay.
tried. Do you know what I mean? So it's sort of it's there and it's moist along, you know, right along the ground, but it's a dark kind of hiding mm-hmm. place. So when they're done feeding, maybe they go in. And then obviously you're going to destroy the ones that you catch.
Right, right, okay.
And then another thing is people have used with varying results diatomaceous earth, which is like
yeah.
a thin layer of that fine, sharp powder,
mm-hmm.
you know. You can't put a thick
okay.
layer on or it's like goo, you know, it gets like plaster. So... And that's what people do when they have a problem with them and they're planting seedlings, you know,
okay.
is that they don't want them to eat the seedlings, similar to like a cutworm or whatever. And so they use the diatomaceous earth along the edge, you know, outside the rows of seedlings on both sides to sort of protect them as a barrier.
Oh, that's a good idea.
So
yeah,
a barrier kind
idea.
Of thing, you know.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I've read about people trying non-toxic slug bait for them. You know, it's like a lot of experimentation, but mostly it's that reducing the population maybe by trapping and then trying to get the area as dry in the later part of the day as possible and eliminate the hiding places or use the hiding places as traps, you know.
I hadn't thought about the traps. I thought about the slug bait and
right.
Had not tried that yet, but that's on my list. And I hadn't thought about the diatomaceous earth either. That's probably a really
yeah.
good idea with
so
the little
yeah.
crustacean bodies.
Yeah, so that's
yeah.
just a couple other ideas.
Maybe wear
okay.
a mask or a bandana.
If you're going to use that, yeah.
Yeah, because
right.
they
okay.
really are little sharp Barbie things. You don't want to be inhaling that if you can help it.
Right.
Just like
okay.
Margaret
said,
it's very dusting.
Right, so it's
right.
and following the package directions carefully on that one for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So,
okay.
Linda.
Well, those are some great ideas.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'll be interested to hear what happens.
Okay,
you're
gonna
have
I'll
to
let
give
you know if I can knock them down some.
We're going to need the update.
okay.
All right, thanks for calling, Linda.
Well, thank you for including me. I
uh-huh.
appreciate it. I enjoyed it.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Ken, questions,
yes,
questions,
yes, yes.
questions. Let's see. I had a question from who, from where? Susan from Facebook. Typically, I treat my tomatoes with copper for blight.
Ooh.
But the tomatoes look great this year. No signs of spots on leaves. Should I treat them anyway?
No.
I know. I'm not a copper. I mean, I'm not into
no.
the copper thing.
Nope.
What
no
people,
copper.
Yeah, people don't know is that, like, the, quote, organic, there are substances, fungicides containing copper that are approved for organic farming, such as organic apple farming, for example, or tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
But copper's residual in the soil for a zillion years, like it doesn't
right.
go away. I don't want to use it. I don't want to participate in that, right? So,
right. Especially if, you know, it's funny, we're talking about the sow bugs with Linda and we're talking about prophylactic measures, but we tend not to want to take prophylactic measures.
Right.
And not treat a problem that we don't have. And if she's got nice looking tomatoes this year, that's that. And I wouldn't use copper for the same reasons that you said.
Yeah.
Yeah. What were you going to say?
No, I was going to say, I've read about this other substance. I've never tried it, but, where for people who want an organic solution, I've read about this fungicide, and I don't even know what really is in it. It's a non-chemical fungicide. I think it's called Actinovate, A-C-T-I-N-O-V-A-T-E. So I've read about that a little bit, but I don't have any firsthand experience. So I'm like kind of interested to see, you know, earlier we were speaking about baking soda and so forth. I'm interested to see like what people are coming up with, because obviously these are problems in agriculture where they need an alternative substance in order to produce a crop in an agricultural situation, you know, a large-scale situation. But keeping the plants clean, spacing them well, lots of air circulation, you know, all those good things, clean mulch or a black plastic layer to prevent, you know, fungal spores dripping, you know, splashing up, all those things are super important. And theoretically, Susan's already doing that because she says she has no signs of spots. I'm not a copper person. I'm just not. I guess we could take one more if I can. You know, I've got these piles of questions. You know how me, I get all, I'm not good with my organizing my printouts over here. Have you ever heard of garlic bloat nematode?
No.
Okay, well, so.
Do I want it?
I don't think you want it. You definitely do not want to get this. I had one, there was a question on Facebook from Camille about garlic, and she says, she's been very successful with garlic, but last year a majority of her crop got hit by the garlic nematode. She did not have her soil tested, was wondering if we have a thought on using the spot next year. She planted elsewhere away from that spot last October. I would not have even known what that meant, even though I grow garlic every year. But I had been to an organic farming conference 2 winters ago, I guess, in my region in the Northeast, and they had a panel about it. And it's apparently it's been around for, I don't know, a zillion years, 100 years, since the 1800s, in fact. In the U.S., I think it was first reported in the 1920s or something. It affects the various alliums, but also other things, from hydrangeas to alfalfa to parsley. I mean, it can be on a lot of different things, Canada thistle. So it's a tricky thing. It's a nematode, you know, it's a little microscopic kind of creature, parasitic nematode. And it disfigures the bulbs and so forth, weakens them. But her question is about, okay, like how long to wait? And this is the bad news. for her, which is it's a super long rotation if you've had any kind of an outbreak like that. It's 4 to 5 years to not be planting in the same area, and that means a good distance. And what's also recommended as an organic approach to help reduce the nematodes is a cover crop that's then turned in that's sort of a natural soil fumigant. And that would be like mustard or rapeseed or oilseed radish or even that sorghum Sudan grass hybrid seed that's used as a cover crop. So cover cropping with one of these sort of natural biofumigants and turning that in. So that's another thing to do. But still, it's like a 4 or 5 year rotation. So I'm sorry to tell her. Camille, I'm sorry.
But, you know, and it, two things. One is that there's good nematodes and bad nematodes, and that's right. Confusing enough. But I think the idea of if you have a problem like fusarium wilt or something,
right.
It's a good idea not to plant in the same
correct.
Place if you can help it.
Correct.
In all cases. And I guess to see if the nematodes are gone, she could wait 4 to 5 years and just do a little bit of a test. But if she's got the space, move the garlic.
Right. Well, Ken, I don't know how we've done it, but we've managed to do it again. We've answered some questions. We should tell people that if they have an urgent garden question, they can always find us either on kendrews.com in the comments or on awaytogarden.com, again in the comments, or the contact form. On facebook.com/awaytogarden is a great place to post your questions as well. And we take sort of a sampling of favorites or best or most common questions each month, and we do this weekly Q&A plus overtime. So I'm going to sign off. Don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. I've just said where you can find us. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.